This episode is brought to you by Hill's Pet Nutrition. Every shelter pet deserves a second chance, and you're making it possible for thousands of them every day. Because when you feed your pet Hill's, you help feed a shelter pet, which helps make them healthy, happy, and more adoptable, changing their life forever. So they can change yours. Over 14 million shelter pets fed and adopted. Science did that. Visit hillspet.com/podcast to learn more.
Good morning, good afternoon, good evening, wherever you are, and welcome to the Politics Guys with your hosts, Jade Parson and Michael Baranowski.
Hello, and welcome to the Politics Guys. I'm Michael Baranowski, a political scientist at Northern Kentucky University. My co-host this week is, as always, Cleveland attorney and sometime Republican strategist Jay Carson, the man to see for all your commercial litigation needs. Before we get started with the podcast today, I wanted to thank all of you who've become regular listeners. If you've been enjoying the Politics Guys and you're listening through iTunes, and most of you are, it seems, I'm hoping you can take a minute to rate the podcast on iTunes and write a review, even if it's a short one. Ratings and reviews are really important in increasing podcast visibility, so by leaving a review, you'd definitely be helping us out. A few of you may be listening to us through Stitcher or another podcast subscription service. Ratings and reviews help there, too. So if you want to lend a hand by reviewing the show, we'd greatly appreciate it. Thanks. Well, obviously, the big story this week was the Supreme Court's 5-4 ruling that found that there is a constitutional right to same-sex marriage in Obergefell versus Hodges. And, of course, that the plaintiff for that is actually someone from my neck of the woods right here in Cincinnati. Justice Kennedy, who wrote the decision, as everyone kind of expected he would, said that while the Constitution contemplates that democracy is the appropriate process for change, individuals who are harmed need not await legislative action before asserting a fundamental right. Something that the dissenters, and that would be Justices Roberts, Scalia, Alito, and who am I missing here?
Well,
Thomas. Thomas, the quietest justice, would definitely disagree with. So what do you think about this, Jay? Gay marriage, fundamental right protected by the Constitution?
Well, first of all, if you know the plaintiff, I just want to point out I know Rick Hodges, the defendant.
Well, isn't that a small world kind of thing?
Small world, exactly. You know, it's Anthony Kennedy's country. We just live in it.
Yeah, it seems that way sometimes.
And I guess that's what troubles me as regular listeners, and even I suppose the irregular listeners of this show probably know. You know, when it comes to gay marriage, I am a conservative who is, I don't know if supportive is the right word, but I'm okay with it.
Tolerate.
I approve of it. I'd say more than tolerate. I think people ought to have the right to marry. Same-sex couples ought to have the right to marry.
So you take more of a libertarian stance on this personally.
Yeah.
Gotcha.
What troubles me and troubles me to a great extent, and this is, I think, what the dissenters said, and I think particularly if you look at the Alito, what he wrote, it's a matter of how do we get there, and do we get a desired, a happy result, but in doing so, do we do damage to our system? And I know that's a tough thing to sell these kind of days, and you know, there's sort of all the triumphalism going on out there, but it's sort of the, you know, and the piece you just read from Kennedy sort of sums that up exactly, that there's a legislative process and this is the way it ought to work, unless I think otherwise, and that's what really bugs me.
Well, yeah, and I think the unless I think otherwise involves that determination of what exactly we mean by a fundamental right. And
yeah,
if someone's fundamental rights are being violated, then you wouldn't wait for the legislative process to correct that, because that's, you know, that's something that can be addressed through the legal system, through the judiciary.
Right. But I think the big problem, and this is, you know, really where the Kennedy piece goes astray, the Kennedy opinion,
so much of it, it's the florid language. It's about love being fundamental and all this emotional, I mean, I'll say clap.
And let's get this out of the way right now. I think both the left and the right can agree that the Justice Kennedy is oftentimes a pompous windbag.
Yeah. Oh, yes, please. The sort of, I don't know, almost self-congratulatory.
Oh, God, yeah.
You know, way of writing this. And
he writes awful opinions, I think.
And you know, I read this as something else from, I think it was Vox or Slate. And I always sort of confused the two. But
easy to do.
About how upon a hearing or reading the opinion, you know, brought tears to people's eyes.
That makes me roll my eyes, but okay.
And to me, if there's any like test of this is a bad court decision, it's that it's an emotionally, you know, brings tears to your eyes.
And that's
that,
not.
That tends to me that to say that it is probably long on emotion and button pushing and short on legal reasoning.
And that's not to say that it's not understandable to have an emotional reaction. I saw one of the many posts when my Facebook exploded after the decision. I saw, you know, a map of the United States all colored in one color. It said, you know, here's where Americans can now legally, you know, same-sex couples can marry. And I got to say, I got a little choked up. But I think the point I think that you're making here is, and that I agree with, is there a place for that in a legal decision? I think I feel that maybe not so much, you know. And I actually, I wanted to talk about that a little bit. And since you brought it up in a way, I wanted to address that now. We might as well. You know, I'm kind of troubled by the fact that more and more it seems like Supreme Court opinions, both the opinions and the dissents, sound more and more like something you'd read on the Huffington Post or Red State than they do a legal opinion, which is not to say there's not a place for strong legal writing. But when it gets that emotive, whether it's positive or negative, I think it really takes something away from the legitimacy of the court. And I blame the justices for that, both on the left and the right.
I think there's something to that. I'm wondering, this isn't something I've really given any study to, but if these more emotional opinions arise in cases like this, where there is quite frankly no real precedent to talk about. Mm-hmm. And that's what, you know, again, troubles me. And I think, you know, there's a lot of conservatives out there who are, you know, shouting, this is the end of the world. It's the end of democracy and so forth. There's some truth to that. But I would say, you know, hasn't it always been thus? I mean, you know, look, this isn't the first time the Supreme Court has issued an opinion that is, you know, basically a policy statement rather than a legally reasoned decision.
I would disagree with you on that, but okay. You necessarily
invite more of just that, you know, emotional. It's like you're making a floor speech in the legislature as opposed to deciding a case or controversy.
Yeah, see, to me, and I think I can agree with you in general on that, but I think in the end, my fundamental take on the decision, both the dissenters and the majority opinion, is that the majority believes that the understanding of what constitutes a fundamental right, this understanding changes over time, and that it's the job of the judiciary to consider that changing understanding when they make decisions. Whereas the minority, I think they agree that the understanding of what constitutes a fundamental right might change over time, but they feel that the judiciary is bound by, I guess you could say, the understanding of what that was at the time the provision of the law or the provision of the Constitution, I guess, was enacted.
I would put a little bit of a gloss on that, and I would say, look, a fundamental right is almost by definition unchanging. It is sort of there pre-existing. Now it may be that it was ignored or overlooked or something like that, and that's why in a lot of cases, when you go to this substantive due process analysis, and which I, you know, most conservative jurists would not be fans of, because it sort of reeks of what they call in the legal circles Lochnerization. We can talk about that in a second. And poor Joseph Lochner is probably turning in his grave right now.
Right.
But it's the idea that, yeah, there are rights that are so inherent to the concept of ordered liberty, is one phrase that the court has used to describe fundamental rights, that they're just part of it. And a lot of they look to sort of natural law or to the, you know, long-term law of England. And so for they, you know, harkens back to things that are beyond our Constitution, predate our Constitution. And to some extent, I think there's nothing wrong with that. But you've got to do some actual real intellectual heavy lifting to get there. And I don't think that Kennedy did that.
And
the other thing is, I mean, this is really getting the legal weeds too, but, and I think there could have been a better equal protection argument made as opposed to fundamental substantive due process. Right. But,
yeah.
But the Kennedy thing is all just sort of a muddle, and that's what the problem is. It's all just,
And if we can kind of pull back on that, I think that's an important point, is that the majority based their opinion largely on this idea of due process, what you call substantive due process. And that's something that drives a lot of conservatives and certainly Justice Scalia kind of crazy, this idea of creating new rights, essentially, whereas
those were essentially substantive due process sort of began in the Griswold case. And I guess there was some before that. And I'm forgetting the name of the case now, but what sort of grew into Roe versus Wade, right, where you're not talking about equal protection, you're talking about just a general sense of fairness that this ought to be the way it ought to be.
Yeah, and that drives me crazy too, because I would have come to the same conclusion as the majority did, but I would have based it on equal protection. And for those of the listeners who aren't clear on that, what I mean is the 14th Amendment says that you can't be deprived, states can't deprive citizens of equal protection of the laws. And to me, this is a pretty, you can make a pretty strong equal protection case, but the majority chose not to do that and base it on this substantive due process idea.
Yeah, sort of. And even then, sort of a poorly reasoned, I mean, don't get me started.
And the reason this is important, just to be clear, is that if we're talking about a fundamental right, what the Supreme Court has said in a number of precedents is if the state does something that seems to violate a fundamental right, then they review that under what they call strict scrutiny, which means
right.
That the law in question that the state's trying to pass has to be what they call narrowly tailored to serve a compelling government interest, which is kind of a high bar.
And I would say in 9 out of 10 cases, it is an unreachable bar.
Yeah. And say normally the standard is what's called rational basis scrutiny, which means that it just kind of has to pass the basic sniff test, you know, it has to seem to make some kind of sense, basically.
Right. And I think that's the other reason why the substantive due process, and really, I didn't know we were going to end up going here doing this deep in the legal weeds, but it doesn't make sense, because as the Sixth Circuit decision, which was what was essentially overturned here, discussed, you know, if you're looking at this in any sort of rational basis degree, well, one rational basis is, well, no one's recognized same-sex marriage for, you know, the 5,000 or so years that we've had civilization. You know, so there's sort of a rational basis in that, you know, look, this is not something that anyone has ever, you know, come
right.
on. And it's.
And so the argument essentially is if this is a fundamental right here we're talking about, or if it's not a fundamental right, then we apply the rational basis test, which is essentially as long as what the state is asserting is not patently ridiculous.
Right.
Basically, then it's going to be okay.
And the state's argument is that there is an interest in promoting heterosexual marriage and creating families and family stability and so forth.
Yeah, and I think it's an awful argument, but it's not.
You can degrade, right, exactly. But I think it's an argument that passes a rational basis test.
Yeah, which is an incredibly low bar.
Yeah.
Exactly. So yeah. Anyway, so what else? What else occurred to you about the decision that you thought was notable?
Well, you know, I guess the thing that and again, we talked before the podcast and about sort of cognitive dissonance, and I'm in the same place where, look, I'm happy that the result was reached. I'm terribly upset about the way the result was reached. The idea that the fact that there has been so much progress so quickly on the acceptance of homosexuality and on same-sex marriage, you know, within the last decade, to me, that's all the more reason of why does the court need to jump into this when it is working its way through legislatures and state referenda.
Yeah, well, I think yes and no, I would think, because while 37 states before this ruling allowed same-sex marriage, only 11 of them did that through democratic processes. The rest were through court rulings and so forth. So I appreciate that argument, and I think other things being equal, it absolutely is better to do things through that process. But when it could be decades before people get what I believe is the fundamental right, and Justice Scalia would disagree with me, I think the question here is the fundamental right to marriage. He would say it's the fundamental right to gay marriage or same-sex right. marriage. And I think that's a fundamental misunderstanding of what we're talking about here.
I don't think it's a misunderstanding. I think that's sort of, and you know, someone had mentioned, I think it might have been you, a Facebook post, Loving versus Virginia,
right?
And that's something, to the extent that the majority relied upon precedent, that's something, a case they cited.
And that was the case about
which was about interracial marriage.
Yes.
And I think there's a lot of differences between Loving and this. And the big one is, historically, and if you're going from that natural law substantive due process thing, yes, humankind has always accepted the man-woman marriage. And in fact, if you looked to the law of a lot of states, historic English law, you know, there was no prohibition on interracial marriage. That prohibition arose out of Jim Crow laws in the South and was sort of an artificial, attack, mm-hmm. Essentially to discriminate. I mean, and that's what it was. Whereas same-sex marriage, it's not a matter of there was a conscious effort to discriminate, because nobody really knew that this was even a thing until 15, 20 years ago. Now, I think you could clearly argue that the Ohio Constitutional Amendment did discriminate when it outlawed I think it was same-sex marriage or any approximation thereof, mm-hmm. In Ohio. But there again, I mean, I think that's the better equal protection challenge than the substantive due process challenge. Right. But so that's why I think there's the distinction between Loving and this. And if the idea was, oh, we've always accepted this and this is fundamental, I just don't see the evidence for it, or I don't think that's been well supported. It just strikes me, once again, it's sad when we talk about this all the time, of the constitutional means a policy that I approve of, and unconstitutional means one that I don't.
Exactly. And I guess my take on this is, some people talk about how the court creates rights out of thin air. I would argue that it's more that the court discovers rights, and meaning discovering that those fundamental rights were always there. So they're not creating anything.
And I would say that's the way they ought to do it, to the extent they do it at all. Yeah.
And I think that now, but there was one thing I think that surprised me in reading so much about this decision. One of the many articles I read about this, what came from my buddy Ezra Klein from Vox, and Ezra Klein actually agreed, promoted a view of Justice Scalia, which stunned me.
Right.
The article was called "What Scalia's Same-Sex Marriage Dissent Gets Right About the Supreme Court," and of course, I saw that. That was total clickbait for me.
Right.
Scalia's argument essentially was, "I don't really care so much about gay marriage, but what I care about is the court, this unrepresentative body, making these determinations that should be made through the legislative process." And his concern was that the court, you know, maybe you like this decision, but next time it could be a court that rules on a decision that you don't like. And so it's about judicial overreach. And the thing that Klein pointed out is, he said, Most of the justices are guilty of that. In fact, he argued that Justice Scalia was guilty of that as well, not in this case, but in the previous case, which we'll get to in a minute, the Obamacare case, essentially not being able to resist the impulse to interpret things in such a way to lead to his preferred conclusion, which would be, as Klein would probably put it, the destruction of President Obama's main domestic policy achievement.
Right.
And I think there is something to be said for that argument, and anyone should be concerned about 9 unrepresentative, unelected people in for life making these kind of big decisions.
And I think that hits the nail on the head as far as the what is the traditional classical conservative view of what the judiciary ought to do is that decide cases and controversies and stay the hell out of policymaking. So what do you think? Let's talk about the Obamacare, which is in some ways, I mean, if it hadn't been for the same-sex marriage decision, would have been a big deal.
Definitely.
I would say in a lot of ways, from a purely legal standpoint, it's less of a big deal because while it's important from a policy standpoint that it preserves Obamacare, the actual legal issues, it came down to statutory interpretation of one part of the Affordable Care Act. There's no broader constitutional, discussion or new fundamental rights or any kind of thing
right.
going on.
Yeah, I think just to be clear, what the challengers were arguing was that there was a clause in the Affordable Care Act that said that tax benefits that people get who sign up for exchanges were eligible when they enrolled in an exchange established by a state. That was the exact language. And they said, well, okay, if that's the case, that means that everyone who's enrolled in an exchange, but a federal exchange, therefore is not eligible for those benefits. And if they're not eligible for those benefits, all of a sudden insurance becomes unaffordable for them. They're allowed to drop out of insurance because of what's called a hardship exemption. And what happens to the insurance markets then is only the sickest people stay in, and the insurance markets essentially self-destruct over a period of time.
Death spiral.
Death spiral.
Is the often used term, yes.
Exactly. And so that was the argument. And what the court said in this decision, and this was a 6-3 decision where Justice Roberts wrote the decision, and he was joined by Kennedy, Ginsburg, Breyer, Sotomayor, and Kagan, said essentially that, yes, that does say exactly what it says. But if you take a look at the context of if you read the entire thing, and that's quite a job, given
right.
how big
Which
it
no
is.
Which no one's really done. Come on.
But if you read the – if you take a look at it in context, it's pretty clear that what happened here is they screwed up this passage and that the entire legislation makes no sense. It reaches essentially an absurd conclusion if we take this for what it actually – what the words actually say.
And unless one were to go with the Gruber argument, which he went around preaching all along – is that the point of that was to create an enticement or encourage states to create their own exchanges.
I mean, that's Jonathan Gruber, one guy who made a couple of comments and that the right totally freaked out about. And understandably so. They were looking for anything that they could do to kill Obamacare. God, I mean, the House voted against it 50-some times.
Let's call it like it is, though. I mean, what happened in this case was – the language, by everyone's agreement, would seem not to allow subsidies.
And Justice Roberts
said
that.
There is a long-held principle in the law that expressio unius exclusio alterius.
Latin. Very good.
Exactly. It's also –
That's how you know it's long-held, because it's in Latin.
Exactly. But no, it means expression of one is to be read as the exclusion of the other. That is just standard stuff that if you say by the state, that means by the state. And, acts, congressional acts are drafted by lots of very, very smart people. They're, lobbyists from, top law firms. They are the best and the brightest from our best law schools. There are representatives who are elected, many who have, legal educations. And there's professional staff people in the House and Senate that that work on drafting these things.
But that's true.
You got to say, look, it says what it says. And this is like, look, we're saying Congress screwed up. So the court's going to give them an assist on
this. But a lot of times what happens, and you know this, of course, is that even with all those really good people writing that, things get in that, or mistakes get in, drafting errors and so forth. That happens all the time. And most of the time in the normal course of business, what happens is they can submit technical changes after the fact, and no one has a problem with it. But this, of course, after the fact was gone over with a fine tooth comb, which is understandable. And this was, I mean, what the majority concluded was this was a drafting error, essentially. Right. And the minority, especially Justice Scalia, practically had a stroke about this. And it led to, in one of the, again, this is Facebook exploded a little bit less the day before. Somebody who I follow suggested that Justice Scalia was a lot like George Costanza in this. And it was
George Costanza kind of week.
Yes, a bad week for Justice Scalia. But it was really kind of, a good analogy here. And this is the famous, what I think is the famous, if you're a certain age, the famous Moop scene where George Costanza is playing Trivial Pursuit with the bubble boy. Kid in a bubble and so forth. And it's probably better just to kind of play the audio as opposed to try to explain it. So let me do that.
Okay. History. This is for the game. How you doing over there? Not too good.
All right, bubble boy. Let's just play. Who invaded Spain in the 8th century?
That's a joke. The Moors.
Oh, no. I'm so sorry. It's the Moops. The correct answer is the Moops.
Moops? Let me see that. That's not Moops, you jerk. It's Moors. It's a misprint.
I'm sorry. The card says Moops.
It doesn't matter. It's Moors. There's no Moops.
It's Moops.
Moors.
And I think that
God bless you. Yeah, God bless Scalia. No, look, I think that's a funny comparison. And yes, if the act had actually said it's the Stutz or something like that, you know, and there was a misprint of that type, it would be spot on. But when you're talking about what the court did, which was insert a couple of words into the statute in order to save it, I think that's different as problematic.
Yeah, I don't think they inserted words. I think they just read the context of the legislation.
They essentially inserted the words state after state. They inserted the words or federal, and that makes a big difference. And you know, to me, it looks. I think this was a. Roberts reached out because this was a big deal. Would they have done this on some other piece of legislation? Would they have done this in the interpretation of some obscure federal rule on, you know, I don't know, who knows what, but, you know, timber rights or you know, something like that? No, but this was a big deal. I think Roberts recognized if the subsidies were eliminated, there would be substantial confusion, harm, people thrown off of things. It would be a mess. So he did this, and they tweaked it and gave the legislature the assist.
See, I think Justice Roberts was actually. I have actually come out of this with more respect for him than I went into it earlier in the week. I think that in both of these cases, what impresses me about Justice Roberts, even though I don't agree with his. His ruling or his process in the gay marriage case is that in both cases, he exercised, I think, admirable judicial restraint. In both cases, he deferred to the will of the legislature as best he understood it. And that's not something you can say, I don't think, about any of the other justices here in looking at both cases.
You know, I would say I would agree with you as to Roberts on the last Obamacare case. Giving deference to the legislature on this, I think he gave too much deference. And again, just from principles of statutory construction, as Scalia would tell you, and the other dissenters would tell you, it's one thing to give the legislature the benefit of the doubt and to presume the constitutionality of a statute. It's another to take the, you know, the language as written and interpret it, you know, add words in. To me, you know, again, the primary goal of statutory interpretation, you have to look at the words. If there's something unclear about the words, well, then you can maybe get into legislative history. But it's a secondary thing. And the reason for that is because we have written laws and they're written down for an important reason. And if it's a matter of, well, it's close enough and that's what they meant, you do a disservice to democracy. Democracy doesn't work as well. Because legislators aren't held as accountable to what they actually produce.
I guess what one thing that troubles me is that, you know, even if I grant that point, back in 2012, in the previous Obamacare case, Justice Scalia himself said that without these subsidies, the exchanges wouldn't operate as Congress intended. And right. He somehow forgot all about his decision. Now, Justice Roberts actually cited Scalia in support of his argument there. And Scalia, of course, like I said, conveniently forgot about that.
Yeah.
And see, that exactly is why Ezra Klein, I think, liked that article or liked that, you know, that point that Scalia made in the gay marriage case is that this you know, judicial overreach is really easy to do. And Justice Scalia, I think, did it here. And I think he would have been very inconsistent. For instance, in this case, he's saying that, well, the law says exactly what it says it does. But yet in the gay marriage case, he wants to read all kinds of stuff into what the Equal Protection Clause means. Say, well, let's look at what the laws were back then and other things and so forth. So I think he's picking and choosing, you know, little bits to kind of get to his preferred ideological outcome. And I don't think Justice Roberts is doing that. And for that, even though I don't agree with him some of the time, I certainly can respect him a lot more than Justice Scalia, who I enjoy. God knows I love reading him in dissent. Well, first off, because I'm probably going to disagree with him on policy, but also because he's funny as hell. But, you know, I think that maybe actually does some real damage to the process.
Well, you know, I'm not going to argue. I could argue with you on some sort of distinctions between the two cases and where Scalia is and that. But I think it would we would really be getting into the legal weeds
right.
and so forth then. But I'd point out. Back in 1987, I think it was 88, Robert Bork wrote a book called The Tempting of America.
I remember it well, seven on my bookshelf, yeah.
Yeah, and Bork made the point that I think you've just made today, and I would agree today, and that is when you allow the judiciary to make policy, there's the temptation, and it's not the temptation to do something bad. Sort of big, and I don't want to use the word dictatorship because that's not what I'm talking about. Oligarchies, sort of the platonic guardians. When you get this, these situations never arise out of an intent to do evil or do wrong. The temptation is to use power to do something good. But as you point out, and this is, again, sort of classic conservative Burkean, Lockean philosophy, is that you can't trust anybody to do good. And,
that's right.
Lord Acton also, absolute power corrupts absolutely. And it's – so I look back to just I almost said Justice Bork. What a world we would be in if –
very different, yeah.
The case, uh-huh. Right?
Yeah, for sure.
But Judge Bork's discussion, and I really think people ought to consider this. As they're celebrating the same-sex marriage decision – consider what if Ezra Klein and Robert Bork are saying the same thing, you know, there might be something to it.
Yeah, definitely.
And there is a sense of we lose a little bit of democracy. And it's not the end of the world. It's not, you know, the end of America, as some conservatives would say. But it's a little bit of a chipping away. And there's the problem of what's next. And you might not like the next decision as much.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Hey,
you know, I'd also, and again, I'm gonna. This is completely geek out because not only you know would I reference Robert Bork, but also Tolkien. You know, if you've read The Lord of the Rings or seen the movies, I mean, that's what this is all about. That you know, when you can have something that would give you absolute power, and there's the sense that, yeah, I'd do something really good with it.
Mm-hmm.
I wouldn't be corrupted, but the problem is, you know. People are fallible and they are going to screw up. And even with the best of intentions, you're going to get a result that is at best undemocratic and could be much worse.
Absolutely. Well, you know, we're running kind of short on time, but I wanted to end on kind of a lighter note, at least what I think is a lighter note. Earlier in the week, and I think this is about as light as it gets, that Bobby Jindal entered the presidential race.
Yeah.
So that's what I like to think of as Bobby Jindal threw his hat into the ring to be the next multimillion-dollar correspondent commentator for Fox News.
That could be. That could be. And I like Jindal. I think he's fine. I don't think he's got any anything that makes him stand out against the other folks in the field. It's, I guess, I suppose, exciting to have an Indian American candidate. But he's not saying anything new. He's not. I don't think he's particularly dynamic. He's got some baggage, and Louisiana doesn't bring anything particular to the equation.
No, not hardly.
In terms of electoral states.
In the article that I read about the announcement, I love this line. It said, in a telephone survey, 0% of Republican primary voters said Mr. Jindal was their top pick to be the nominee. Well, he's got nowhere to go but up.
What was the margin for error on that, though? I mean, it was sort of
funny. How sad. How very sad. But, I wish him well in his quixotic quest for the presidency, I suppose.
Or he could end up, the cabinet, secretary, undersecretary of something or other.
Yeah, and, I think that's a little more. I don't even think he's likely to get a VP nod from anyone.
I don't think he adds anything electorally or philosophically that you can't get elsewhere.
Not hardly.
Yeah.
All right. Well, I think that's about it for us for this week's episode. Thanks.
That was a good show. Yeah. We could have kept talking for quite a while.
Oh, absolutely. We definitely.
Definitely.
Yeah, a lot of fun stuff, at least for us, certainly. So hopefully for the listeners, too. But if you are still listening, thank you very much for listening. And if you have any thoughts, comments, or criticisms, we would love to hear from you. Our email is politicsguys@gmail.com. That's politicsguys, one word, @gmail.com. If you're listening to us on iTunes or Stitcher, we really would appreciate it if you could take a minute to rate the show and write a quick review there. You can follow us throughout the week on Twitter. Our handle is Politics Guys. We'll be back next Sunday. We hope you'll join us.